Let's continue. Well, let's begin our newspaper coverage for today. It's Thursday, the 11th of September, 2025. And we begin our newspaper coverage here on the Talking Information Center with the Wall Street Journal. And we say hello and good morning to Pamela.
Good morning. From the front page, conservative activist Kirk is shot dead. Trump ally struck down at long range while giving a talk at Utah University. Conservative political activist and author Charlie Kirk was shot and killed Wednesday while giving a speech at Utah Valley University. Police were searching for an assailant who fired a single shot from hundreds of yards away. FBI Director Kash Patel said a suspect was in custody, then said the person was released. Our investigation continues, he posted on X. The death of Kirk added another fatality to a season of violence that has rattled Americans and deepened the sense of a nation at war with itself. Kirk, 31 years old and a married father of two, was one of the most influential figures on the right and founder and CEO of Turning Point USA, a conservative youth organization active in more than 3,500 college campuses. Kirk hosted a popular podcast and was known for hosting debates on college campuses. He also played a prominent role in President Trump's outreach to young voters during the 2024 election. Trump blamed the radical left for comparing Kirk and others like him to Nazis, mass murderers, and criminals. This kind of rhetoric is directly responsible for the terrorism that we're seeing in our country today, and it must stop right now, he said in a video message from the Oval Office. The bullet that struck Kirk as he spoke in an open-air courtyard was believed to have been fired from a roof of a building 200 yards away, a university spokeswoman said. Kirk was making the first stop in his fall American Comeback speaking tour, in which the rhetorically gifted activist would dare students to prove me wrong. He took the stage around noon local time in a courtyard and was seated beneath a small tent on an 86-degree day. In the sea of about 3,000 people that surrounded him, MAGA hats and attire were plentiful. Some students craned from nearby buildings to get a look. Standing behind him were what appeared to be security agents. Not long into the session, an audience member appeared to challenge Kirk about his transgender issues. Do you know how many transgender Americans have been mass shooters over the last 10 years? Kirk was asked, a reference to a recent shooting in Minneapolis in which the suspect identified as a transgender woman. Too many, Kirk replied, and the crowd whooped. The speaker said, answering his own question, now five is a lot, right? I'm going to give you some credit. Then he asked, do you know how many mass shooters there have been in America over the last 10 years? Counting or not counting gang violence, Kirk asked, sitting back in his chair. Then, as he lowered the microphone, a shot ran out. There was a juddering instant in which Kirk recoiled before slumping to his left. Blood sprayed from his neck. Chaos and screams erupted. Get down, get down, get down, someone urged. We heard the gunshot. We were really scared for our lives, said Emma Tanner, 21, who was active in the university's Turning Point chapter. She left her bag and her keys and ran. Kirk was rushed by a security team to a hospital, according to the university. Students were told to secure in place at the campus in Orem, which has been closed the rest of the week. Over 46,000 students were enrolled in the university, making it the largest in the state. Kirk's visit had sparked some protest. Kirk's presence and the messages he delivers stand in contrast to the values of understanding, acceptance, and progress that many of us hold dear, a Change.org petition against his event read. The university stuck with its plan. In a statement last week, it said it upholds First Amendment rights and fosters an environment where ideas, popular or controversial, can be exchanged freely, energetically, and civilly. A college dropout, Kirk started his activism in 2012 and used his organization to attract cultural figures on the right at his conferences. Leaders in both parties decried the shooting. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said he was heartbroken and outraged. Former President Barack Obama, a Democrat, said, "This kind of despicable violence has no place in our democracy." Utah Governor Spencer Cox, a Republican, called the killing a political assassination and said our nation is broken. On social media, there were many posts carrying news of the shooting and rumors and speculation about Kirk's condition. At the White House, some aides had tears in their eyes as they scanned their phones for updates. Security has been an ever-present worry for them since a young man with a long gun nearly assassinated Trump at a Pennsylvania rally in 2024. At 4:40 p.m., Trump issued a social media announcing Kirk's death. He called for flags to be lowered to half-staff in honor of a truly great American patriot. Health insurance costs for businesses surge. U.S. businesses are facing the biggest health insurance cost increases in at least 15 years, after already steep boosts in recent years have pushed the annual expense for family coverage high enough to equal the price of a small car. Costs for employer coverage was expected to surge to about 9.5% in 2026, according to an estimate from Aon. One employer survey by WTW suggests 9.2%. Both benefits consulting firms' projections, which were provided exclusively to the Wall Street Journal, would represent the fastest rate of increase since at least 2011, when the price tags for employer coverage were far lower than the recent average of about $25,500 for a family plan. Other employer surveys conducted this year have generated similar findings: sharp hikes in health coverage spending for the next year, on top of 2 years of significant increases. "It's an unsustainable number for a lot of employers," said Sean Greminger, chief executive of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions, which represents employers. The reaction from employers to the increases ranges between upset, shocked, freaked out, and resigned, he said. Insurers said rising premiums for health coverage are driven by the growing cost of health care. The causes include higher prices for hospital care, expanding use of services, due in part to higher prevalence of conditions such as cancer in the working age population, and pricey drugs, including the popular weight loss and diabetes treatments known as GLP-1s. Employers are moving to blunt the spike, and tactics such as changing plan designs are likely to shave a percentage point or two from the average increase, the benefits firm said. Some are pushing more costs to employees through larger payroll deductions for premiums or higher out-of-pocket charges, such as deductibles. "It's a hard choice that makes you sick to your stomach," said Troy Morris, CEO of Cal Morris, a space services company in Marquette, Michigan, with about 20 employers. His firm pays the entire cost of its workers' premiums and has long tried to hold down what they pay to access care, he said. The cost of the company's health plan grew about 20% for the plan year that started August 1st, after a 9% increase in 2024. Cal Morris ended up sticking with the same plan design. However, the plan's out-of-pocket maximum, the annual cap on what workers might have to pay for care, increased to $10,000 per family, up from $8,150. In one sign of corporate America's dissatisfaction with the health coverage status quo, the WTW survey, which was performed this summer and largely focused on bigger employers, found that 60% were planning to look at replacing their health insurer or pharmacy benefits manager in the next few years. It also found that nearly a third of employers surveyed are giving priority to new plan designs that include changes such as limits on access to certain doctors or hospitals. Mutual of Omaha, which sells life insurance and other financial products, expects to launch a process later this year to find new health plan and drug benefits administrators after seeing healthcare costs increase by double digits this year. The company wants to include smaller vendors offering alternative products, not just the giants that serve most employers, said Stephen Schlange, vice president of human resources. The Omaha, Nebraska-based company, with about 6,300 employees, this year stopped covering GLP-1 drugs for weight loss, a category that includes Wegovy and Zepbound. Rising employer health care costs are driven in part by the impact of inflation, which has been playing out in higher prices negotiated by hospital systems. "This is the worst I've seen in rapid escalation of health care costs," said Pam Cahaley, CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona. She points to more aggressive billing by some health care providers, potentially powered by artificial intelligence tools. In addition, people are using more health care services, partly due to rising care for serious health issues such as cancer, cardiovascular conditions such as atrial fibrillation, and musculoskeletal problems that can lead to lower back and joint procedures, said Kirk Roy, chief actuary at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. "Diseases that we usually thought as for elderly, we're seeing more and more in the younger, working-age population, he said. NATO member planes shoot down Russian drones deep inside Poland. NATO member warplanes shut down several Russian drones over Poland, the first time the alliance has engaged Russian drones over a member's territory over what officials contend was a test of its defenses by Moscow. The incident, which Polish authorities said involved 19 incursions into its airspace, led authorities to close major Polish airports for the first time since the Ukraine war began. "We are dealing likely with a provocation on a large scale," said Prime Minister Donald Tusk of Poland, a North Atlantic Treaty Organization member, following an emergency meeting of ministers on Wednesday. Russian warplanes have long tested NATO's responses by flying near or even into the airspace of alliance members. NATO countries rotate air policing duties along alliance borders. Those cat-and-mouse encounters involving traditional crewed aircraft have become more brazen since Russia's large-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, but remain on the alliance's periphery. Tuesday's night's drone incursions reached further west over Poland than at any time previously reported during the war. President Trump, who this month met with President Karol Nawrocki of Poland in the White House, expressed consternation at the incursions. "What's with Russia violating Poland's airspace with drones?" Trump posted on Truth Social. "Here we go." Asked whether NATO regarded the incident as a deliberate attack or a mistake, NATO General Secretary Mark Rutte said the full assessment was continuing. "Whether it was intentionally or not, it was absolutely reckless. It's absolutely dangerous," Rutte said. "I think last night showed that we're able to defend every inch of NATO territory, including, of course, its airspace." Dutch F-35 and Polish F-16 jet fighters were involved in the operation to down the drones, some of which entered via Belarus, developments that Tusk said were unprecedented. "Some 3 to 4 drones that pose a direct threat were shot down," the Polish prime minister said. "I'm glad the Dutch F-35 fighter jets were able to provide support. The Netherlands stands shoulder to shoulder with our NATO ally, Poland," Dick Schoof, the prime minister of the Netherlands, wrote on X. German Patriot air defense systems in Poland were also placed on alert. An Italian airborne early warning plane and an aerial refueler were launched during the incident, said Colonel Martin L. O'Donnell, a spokesman for NATO's military command. "Increasing evidence indicates that this movement, this direction of strike, was no accident," President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine wrote on X, adding that the use of combat aircraft from several European countries simultaneously to shoot down Russian weapons and protect human lives is highly significant. After the incursions, Belarus said it had warned Poland about the likelihood of drones entering its territory as a result of electronic warfare deployed by Ukraine to counter the latest Russian attack. "This helped the Polish side react quickly to the drone activity," said Pavel Muravieko, the head of Belarus's armed forces. He added that Belarus had also shot down drones that entered its airspace as a result of jamming. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov declined to comment specifically on the incident, but said the leadership of the European Union and NATO nearly daily accused Russia of provocations, most often without even trying to present their line of reason. Russia's defense ministry said it had no plans to strike any targets in Poland and was ready to carry out consultations with the Polish military on the incident. It also said the drones have crossed the border with a flight limit of around 400 miles, a distance that could make them launching from Russia difficult. Experts said images posted on Polish state media of the small aircraft suggest they were Russian reconnaissance drones or decoys, most likely the Gabera model. Serhii Beskrestovnov, a Ukrainian expert on electronic warfare, said the use of Gabera drones, which can serve as reconnaissance purpose when outfitted with a camera, suggests Russia was testing NATO's resolve by forcing Poland and its allies to scramble air defenses, allowing Moscow to assess the speed and efficiency of the response. Gabera drones are more vulnerable to spoofing than the explosive Shahed drones that the Russia normally uses to strike targets in Ukraine, Beskrestov said. But he said it's unlikely the drones could have veered far into Polish airspace as a result of Ukrainian spoofing, both because of their sheer number and because their satellite navigation and autonomous inertial systems would have corrected their trajectory once they were pushed off course. The zone of Ukrainian spoofing usually stretches to around 15 miles, he said. Drone parts have been found more than 100 miles inside Poland. The distance is too large for Ukrainian spoofing. It's technically not possible, he said. NATO's Assembly of National Representatives, the North Atlantic Council, was briefed on the incident and the alliance response during a scheduled meeting Wednesday in Brussels. Secretary General Rutte is in touch with Polish leadership, and NATO is consulting closely with Poland, spokeswoman Alison Hart wrote on X. Russian drones have increasingly crossed into Polish airspace from Ukraine in recent weeks, as Moscow has expanded its attacks on Ukrainian cities. NATO regularly scrambles its warplanes to counter threats from the conflict in Ukraine along its eastern flank. But this represents the first time NATO members have operated in concert to shoot down Russian weapons over a member's territory. The incident occurred amid heightened tension, coinciding with large-scale Polish military exercises that started this month. Russia is also set to begin its annual strategic exercises on its western flank, including in its ally Belarus, which borders Poland. Those exercises, known as Zapad 2025, have triggered security concerns along the eastern flank of NATO members' territory. Poland closed its borders with Belarus on Tuesday. Drone parts were found in the villages of Myślokow, central Poland, and Zasniski, in the country's southeast, among other places, the local mayor said. During the first months of the war, a Russian missile attack ended in the deaths of two people in eastern Poland, though a later investigation showed the deaths were likely caused by Ukrainian air defense missiles. Inside Ukraine, the consular section of Poland's embassy in Kyiv was struck in a drone attack on July 4th, but no staff were injured, and a major Polish-owned factory was also struck in the middle of that month. Fed veers toward a meeting with cast barely set. President Trump's unprecedented bid to wrest greater control of the Federal Reserve barreled toward a suspense-filled conclusion Wednesday amid two parallel efforts to decide who will be able to participate at next week's interest rate meeting. Late Tuesday, a federal judge granted Fed Governor Lisa Cook an injunction that temporarily halted Trump's attempt to remove her. The decision was a crucial legal victory for Cook and the central bank's independence more broadly because it allows her to remain in her job for now. It clears the path for her to vote at a consequential Fed meeting next week when officials are expected to make their first interest rate cut of the year. On Wednesday morning, attention shifted to the Senate Banking Committee, where Republicans rushed to confirm a Trump advisor, Stephen Miran, to fill a separate vacancy on the Fed's board, setting up the possibility of a Senate floor vote as soon as this week that would allow him to join the same meeting. A quarter-point rate cut at next week's meeting is widely expected after a string of lackluster employment readings this summer. The rate-setting Federal Open Market Committee consists of 12 members, the 7 Fed governors, and 5 regional Fed bank presidents. Cook's legal challenge has quickly become the defining battle in Trump's effort to reshape the relationships between the White House and the Fed. Congress restructured the central bank in the 1930s to insulate presidentially appointed governors from political pressure, giving them 14-year terms and protection from removal except for cause. Trump has repeatedly criticized the Fed's interest rate decisions and upbraided Chair Jerome Powell. The administration said in a court filing Wednesday that it was appealing the decision to let Cook remain on the board. To circumvent removal protections that Fed governors have long enjoyed, Trump last month cited alleged mortgage fraud as justification for firing Cook. Lawyers for Cook, who hasn't been charged with the crime, said she had no opportunity to defend herself against the allegations. They deny she committed fraud and argued any alleged wrongdoing didn't meet the legal standards for removal. U.S. District Judge Gia Cobb largely embraced Cook's legal arguments. Cobb ruled that Cook is substantially likely to succeed on her claim that Trump violated the Federal Reserve Act because a reported termination didn't comply with the requirement that officials can only be removed for cause. The case could quickly reach the Supreme Court, The court is expected to weaken job protections at independent federal agencies in other cases that are headed its way, but it went out of its way in a ruling this past May to suggest that Fed might be treated differently from other agencies by highlighting its unique historical role. Analysts said the ruling highlighted how the president's hasty dismissal, days after another administration official alleged that Cook had made false representations on mortgage loan applications in 2021 to secure better terms, enabled her to retain her job for now. Cook's position would be untenable if she had been unable to rebut allegations of wrongdoing after having been given time to do so in a process that was not selective and partisan, said Krishna Guha, vice chairman at Evercore ISI. Cook's lawyers haven't provided a detailed explanation of the circumstances around the mortgages. Experts have said almost any reputable lawyers wouldn't allow their client to publicly disclose that information now that the Justice Department has opened a separate criminal investigation. Because no president has ever attempted to remove a Fed governor, the for cause language in the Federal Reserve Act hasn't ever been interpreted by a court. Cobb said the removal standard only applied to concerns about a Fed official's ability to effectively and faithfully execute their job in light of events that have occurred while they are in office. Cobb said the arguments Trump's lawyers have provided to support his attempted firing of Cook would so neuter the removal protections as to provide no functional limitation on the ability to remove a Fed governor. Several Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee have declined to say whether Trump was right to attempt to fire Cook. Several signaled no desire last week to confirm a Cook replacement, so long as a court allows Cook to remain. Separately, the committee voted 13-11 to advance Moran's nomination on Wednesday, a notable step given how Moran has agreed to a never-before-seen arrangement that will allow him to take an unpaid leave from his current White House job so that he can return after his time on the Fed boards concludes. Moran, who in March was confirmed as the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, would fill a Fed seat that expires on January 31st. The governors can stay on the board for longer if a successor hasn't been confirmed by then. Democrats have said the dual-headed role would make a mockery of the Fed's independence from the executive branch. Moran has pledged to act independently on the job. Republicans have barely flinched at the arrangement. In fact, they are advancing Moran's nomination at near breakneck speed, making him eligible for a Senate vote just 8 days after his nomination was received from the White House. Korean detainees set to return home. Last-minute hitches put exit in limbo after immigration raid at Hyundai plant. The South Koreans detained after an immigration raid in Georgia were expected to return home on Thursday, according to government officials. It wasn't immediately clear how many of the roughly 300 South Koreans would board a midday chartered flight from Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson Airport, or the conditions of their release after roughly a week of detention. South Korean officials had earlier targeted a Wednesday departure, though they said a delay had occurred due to unspecified circumstances on the U.S. side. The South Koreans were scheduled to be first picked up by bus between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. local time Thursday from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Detention Center in Folkestone, Georgia, government officials said. The drive to the airport is more than 250 miles. On Wednesday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio met his South Korean counterpart, Cho Hyun. Seoul's former ministry said the two sides had discussed details of a return of the workers at an electric vehicle battery plant, jointly run by Hyundai Motor and LG Energy Solution near Savannah, Georgia. Cho had strongly requested the detained South Koreans be allowed to depart on terms that wouldn't hinder future visits to the U.S., Seoul's foreign ministry said. They should be allowed to leave without being cuffed, Cho told Rubio, since they're not criminals. Rubio, in the meeting, reinforced the strength of the two countries' alliance and added that the U.S. welcomes South Korean investment into America, according to a State Department spokesman who didn't mention the detainees. The South Koreans have been behind bars since the September 4th immigration raid. In total, some 475 individuals were arrested. A key issue has been whether the detained South Koreans would be allowed to leave voluntarily or be deported. If they are deported, they would be typically barred from entering the U.S. again for years. Even a voluntary departure could entail challenges for reentering the U.S. if it is conditioned on the South Koreans admitting that they violated visa rules. U.S. authorities have said those arrested in the raid illegally crossed the border, entered through a visa waiver program that prohibited them from working or overstayed their visas. They haven't said which of those descriptions applies to detained South Koreans or offered evidence of any possible violations. The factory under construction in Georgia is a joint venture between Hyundai and fellow South Korean firm LG Energy, a battery maker. It is part of the $7.6 billion Hyundai Metaplant manufacturing complex that Georgia has described as the largest economic development project in the state's history. Visas have been a nagging problem. Hyundai and LG Energy each filed a complaint to South Korea's foreign ministry in April and May asking for help with the U.S. visa issues, according to documents obtained by ruling party lawmaker Kim Young-bae. Seoul's foreign ministry said it had reached out to the Trump administration 52 times during his second term to discuss visa issues for Korean businesses. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said Tuesday that the Department of Homeland Security and Department of Commerce were working together to address visa rules for skilled foreign workers. Harris says letting Biden decide on run was reckless. Her Vice President Kamala Harris said in a new memoir that it was reckless to let former President Joe Biden and his wife Jill Biden decide on their own whether he should run for re-election. The stakes were too high for Biden to make this decision without input from others, Harris said in her coming memoir, 170 Days, an excerpt published by The Atlantic. It's Joe and Jill's decision. We all said that, like a mantra, as if we had all been hypnotized, Harris wrote. Was it grace or was it recklessnesses? In retrospect, I think it was recklessness. This wasn't a choice that should have been left to an individual's ego, an individual's ambition, Harris wrote. It should have been more than a personal decision. Harris's memoir, which details her presidential campaign sprint and ultimate loss to Donald Trump, offers her sharpest remarks to date about Biden's decision to seek a second term. The book will be released on September 23rd by Simon & Schuster. A spokeswoman for Biden didn't respond to requests for comment. After unsuccessfully seeking the Democratic nomination for president in 2020, Harris was picked to be Biden's running mate, ultimately becoming the first female vice president. Harris went after Biden during a debate in 2019, castigating him for his views on federally mandated school busing in the 1970s. Harris said in her memoir that she had to prove her loyalty time and time again, in part because of her attack at that debate. Harris also contemplated whether she should have encouraged Biden not to run for a second term. And of all the people in the White House, I was in the worst position to make the case that he should drop out, she wrote. He would see it as naked ambition, perhaps as poisonous disloyalty. While Harris questioned whether Biden should have run for re-election, she defended his mental acuity and his capacity to lead the nation while he was president. Joe Biden was a smart guy with long experience and deep conviction, able to discharge the duties of president, Harris wrote. On his worst day, he was more deeply knowledgeable, more capable of exercising judgment, and far more compassionate than Donald Trump at his best. But at 81, Joe got tired, she wrote. That's when his age showed in physical and verbal stumbles. Tariff case puts into play major new powers for Trump. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear President Trump's appeal of a lower court ruling against his tariffs. His decision could matter well beyond just the levies that Trump imposed in April. If the court sides with Trump, it could hand the president sweeping fiscal authority long the purview of Congress. It could enable the president, by simply invoking an emergency with some foreign element, to justify almost any revenue measure in response, not just tariffs, but other taxes too. Trump officials claim in court and in public that the tariffs in question are targeted and temporary. Far from being permanent, these tariffs end when the emergency ends, Trump's trade advisor Peter Navarro recently wrote. But that's not what Trump himself or the rest of the administration envisions. Trump has said tariffs could replace income taxes, becoming Treasury's primary source of revenue, as they were before 1913. Last week, his budget office projected that tariffs would raise $3.9 trillion, or 1% of GDP, over the coming decade. That sure sounds permanent. Tariffs are taxes, and as a share of GDP, Trump's tariffs in fiscal 2026 would represent one of the largest tax increases since the 1950s, and the largest since 1982, according to the Tax Foundation, a think tank that opposes Trump's tariffs. And unlike the other tax increases, the recent tariffs were enacted entirely at the president's discretion with no vote in Congress. The Constitution grants Congress authority over both taxes and tariffs. This was central to the framers' system of checks and balances. James Madison argued that the president couldn't become king because the purse is in the hands of the representatives of the people. Starting in the 1930s, Congress began delegating some tariff authority to the president to negotiate trade agreements that Congress would then ratify or to address specific problems, such as other countries' unfair practices. Revenue wasn't the goal. Trump, in his first term, and Joe Biden afterward, generally applied tariffs using those statutes. In his second term, Trump had a grander vision: turn the U.S. back into a high-tariff country. To do so, he relied on the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, first to impose steep tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China, and then on almost every major trading partner. That law was generally used to punish national security threats such as Iran and Venezuela through sanctions. Three courts have already ruled that it doesn't permit Trump to impose across-the-board unlimited tariffs. Sectoral tariffs, such as on steel, were imposed under a different law and aren't at issue in the current case. The Supreme Court might not rule clearly for one side or another, but for Trump to win, the court would have to agree with him on several key points. First, the law requires an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States, originating outside its borders. The court would have to defer to Trump's claim that the trade deficit meets that definition, though the U.S. has run a persistent deficit for 50 years, and few economists consider it a threat. Trump cited a different emergency, fentanyl and illegal migration, for tariffs on China, Mexico, and Canada. Second, the court would have to conclude that the tariffs don't conflict with the major questions doctrine, which requires clear statutory authorization for something of exceptional political or economic significance. That's even though the tariffs, in economic impact, dwarf Biden's plan to forgive student debt. The court ruled that Biden's plan did violate the doctrine. Third, the law says the president can regulate importation or transactions involving any property in which any foreign country or a national thereof has any interest, without specifically authorizing tariffs. The court would thus have to agree with Trump that regulate includes tariffs. If regulate can include tariffs, it could, according to several legal scholars, include any tax. Any tax with foreign-born implications would be within his authority, said John Brooks, a professor of tax law at Fordham University. Why wouldn't that apply to any tax he can conceive of, not just the tariffs? He added that as recently as last year, the Supreme Court affirmed that the Constitution treats tariffs and income taxes similarly, that is, as indirect taxes. It would be hard for a court to argue there is something legally or politically different about tariffs from capital taxes or financial transaction taxes, Brooks said. There's a whole bunch of statutes where Congress gives executive agencies and the president the power to regulate, noted Jeffrey Schwab, senior counsel at the Liberty Justice Center, which represent a group of plaintiffs suing Trump. If regulate can mean tax or tariff, does that mean all of a sudden it doesn't even take a vote of Congress to implement a tax? That seems really bad. Imagine, for example, that a president declares the offshoring of jobs a national emergency and imposes a surtax on profits of companies he accused of offshoring. The president could claim that the same deference accorded to Trump on tariffs would apply here. Trump has repeatedly cited foreign policy or national security expanding presidential prerogative, including on taxes. He has claimed that Internal Revenue Service employees don't have the right to collective bargaining, citing national security. America's military, economic, and productive capacity directly depend on revenue the IRS collects, the administration argued in court filings. Trump has often claimed that foreign exporters, not Americans, pay tariffs. In fact, importers, such as retailers, remit the duty to the government. They can, in theory, persuade exporters to absorb some or all of the tariff, or pass it along to their customers. While who ultimately pays can't be known precisely, several economists estimate that American businesses paid 50% to 60% of Trump's tariffs to date, with the balance split roughly between exporters and consumers. So, if the Supreme Court gives Trump what he wants, tariffs could end up as one of the biggest business tax increases in decades, wiping out the tax benefits for expensing capital investment in this year's Republican tax and spending law. There would also be no end to uncertainty. Unlike most other tariff authorities, these tariffs are not enshrined in statute. There's no process to change them, and they can change very rapidly in a day without much notice, as we've seen, said Greta Pesch, a trade attorney at Wiley Rain and former general counsel for the U.S. Trade Representative. And then there are all the other taxes, beside tariffs, Trump could feel free to use. And another story on tariffs. Trump asks EU for tariffs on China and India. President Trump asked the European Union to hit some Chinese and Indian goods with tariffs of up to 100% in a new attempt to ratchet up pressure on Russia over its war in Ukraine, two EU officials said. The request, which comes as the U.S. tries to curb Indian purchases of Russian oil and Chinese support for Russia's economy, was made when Trump dialed into a meeting between the U.S. and EU sanctions officials in Washington on Tuesday, the official said. Trump, at one point, urged the EU to impose a 50% tariff on India and China, and another point said tariffs should be up to 100%, they said. The White House didn't respond to a request for comment on Wednesday. The EU isn't likely to impose such tariffs. One EU official said on Wednesday the bloc doesn't use tariffs to impose sanctions on the country and isn't basing its sanctions discussions on Trump's request. The EU is preparing a 19th package of sanctions against Russia. Last week, the U.S. agreed to resume technical discussions with the EU on Russia's sanctions, which was routine under the Biden administration but hasn't happened since Trump returned to the White House. The bloc is expected to target some foreign firms that are helping Russia, possibly including some Chinese companies, according to diplomats. The EU isn't expected to make moves that would further restrict oil or gas purchases because of political sensitivities within the bloc, the diplomat said. Discussions about the sanctions package are continuing, and it isn't clear what the EU will decide, the diplomat said. European Commissioner President Ursula von der Leyen on Wednesday said more pressure is needed to bring Russia to the negotiating table. We need more sanctions, she said, during an annual State of the Union speech on Wednesday morning. We are particularly looking at phasing out Russian fossil fuels faster, the shadow fleet, and third countries. The EU has previously sanctioned what it refers to as a shadow fleet of ships that transport illicit Russian oil. It has plans to phase out the purchase of Russian oil and gas by the end of 2027. Trump has repeatedly threatened to put economic pressure on Russia, but has backed off on doing so for several occasions. However, Washington did place tariffs on India, which has been buying Russian oil at discounted prices and making money by selling refined products based on Russian crude oil. The EU has put sanctions on Chinese and Indian companies and banks in recent months, targeting those the bloc believes are helping Russia wage its war in Ukraine. However, The bloc has treaded carefully with the Chinese firms amid threats of retaliatory sanctions by Beijing. And the EU is hoping to lock in a free trade agreement with India in the coming weeks. The Financial Times earlier reported that Trump had requested the EU impose tariffs of about 100% on India and China. Apple's tech marvel comes with sacrifices. Our columnist tried out iPhone Air's new slimness, as well as the iPhone 17 line, the AirPods Pro 3, and the latest Apple Watches. The just-announced iPhone Air is an iPhone maxed out on thinness. It's an engineering and design marvel, but I don't think it's the right upgrade for most people. Apple spent a lot of time talking about the Air, which is the first major redesign since the iPhone X in 2017. The Air is maybe less intriguing as a thing to buy and more as a clue to where Apple will take us over the next few years. The basic iPhone 17, which brings a bunch of under-the-hood upgrades, and the iPhone 17 Pro and Pro Max, which gets a new, more durable look and camera improvements, seem more compelling to general iPhone shoppers. There's a lot more to consider from this year's slate of new iStuff, which also includes the next-generation AirPods Pro and Apple Watches. After trying the new iPhones and wearables, here are my biggest takeaways. The Air is beautiful, but for whom? The iPhone Air is 0.22 inches thick. The number probably doesn't mean much on the page, but it's seductively thin. Like Hershey's Bar Thin, I checked. And the light titanium body makes the 6.5-inch display feel smaller. It's a fact. The barely there Air is beautiful. Another fact, the beauty comes at the cost of features we care about. There's just one rear camera. It has a 48-megapixel sensor capable of standard angle shots and just a 2x zoom. And yes, the Air has the same battery life as last year's iPhone 16 Pro, 27 hours of video playback. But it has the shortest battery life across the new iPhone lineup. Apple touted power efficiency gains across its chip and software, but efficiency is no substitute for more battery. I'll soon try living with it and report back on any battery compromises I discover. The Air also costs $999, $100 more than the iPhone 16 Plus model replaces. If you add in the $99 MagSafe magnetic battery pack that Apple is offering to boost battery life, the cost of this basically matches that of a big, beefy, full-featured iPhone 17 Pro. While this phone isn't a practical choice for me, it's potentially appealing to another audience, the world's largest smartphone market. Apple is going to compete head-on with Huawei in China. Counterpoint Research's Neil Shah told me, the only thing missing is now a foldable iPhone. A foldable phone is basically two thin phones hinged together. Are we now looking at the first half of that goal, which analysts expect to be realized next year? Apple wouldn't confirm that. Today's best news, the iPhone 17. The most exciting upgrades are to the standard iPhone. A previously Pro-only feature is trickling down to the $799 model, 120Hz ProMotion display. Once you experience this gracefully fluid screen, it's hard to go back. Scrolling is smoother and the display can be brighter and dimmer than previous iPhone screens. It's going to feel like a big improvement coming from an older phone. That's not the only improvement to the screen. It's more scratch-resistant, too, because of a new ceramic coating. Screen talk too nerdy? How about better selfies? An 18-megapixel center stage front camera is coming to the entire new iPhone lineup. I immediately saw the difference, and the ability to toggle between portrait and landscape orientation without turning the phone sideways is fun and useful. Bumping up both rear cameras to 48 megapixels is a less obvious improvement and will require some testing. I can't wait to try the macro close-ups, another setting borrowed from the pros in my Barton garden. The basic 17 starts at Apple's long-time $799 price, but its storage is now doubled to 256 gigabytes, like the more expensive models. The pros got the real redesign. While the iPhone 17 looks nearly identical to last year's model, the 17 Pro and Pro Max have an entirely different look. Apple says their aluminum build and ceramic coatings on the screen and the back will make them more durable. There's a big raised bar on the back that Apple is calling the Plateau. The three rear cameras, now all with 48 megapixel sensors, live in this bump. The most impressive thing about the Pros is the zoom. The difference between optical and digital zoom here is a little tricky. You get 4x zoom at the full 48 megapixels and 8x optical quality zoom at a lower 12 megapixel resolution. The photos I took at 8x zoom still look fantastic on the iPhone small screen and like nothing I could have taken before on an iPhone, but I want to see them in print or on my TV before making a judgment. This year's Pro costs $100 more than last year's at $1,099. Apple says it's because the storage starts at a higher level, 256 gigabytes instead of 128 gigabytes, but the standard iPhone 17 comes with the same amount of storage without the price hike. My impressions on the other stuff. I also tried the AirPods Pro 3. A cursory headshake proved the Buds' new foamy tips were secure, but only a sweaty run will truly test the fit. The noise cancellation, which Apple says is twice as good as the previous model, sounded impressive too, immediately quieting the chaotic, echoey demo area. They also have AI-powered live translate mode, but the Apple rep said they couldn't try it because of the noise. It's something I'm most looking forward to testing with my Swiss husband. Two more things I couldn't test. The Apple Watch Series 11's high blood pressure alerts, because I need to take a baseline over many days and would only alert me if I had hypertension, and the Watch Ultra's 3 emergency satellite communications, because I was in the basement. Stay tuned for my more in-depth reviews of Apple's September hardware haul. This is an opinion by Carl Rove. GOP has a chance in Michigan. When Republicans last won a U.S. Senate seat in Michigan, families were flocking to theaters to see The Lion King. Sony was releasing the first PlayStation, and Jeff Bezos was founding Amazon in a garage. That was 1994. Next year could break the trend. Like some other battleground states that have been firmly blue for generations, Michigan has trended red recently. Republicans are targeting an open Senate seat in the midterms, and they could flip it. The GOP has settled on Mike Rogers as its nominee. Backed by President Trump, Mr. Rogers is an Army veteran who has served as an FBI special agent, a seven-term congressman, and a House Intelligence Committee chairman. Smart and outgoing, he nearly won the state's other Senate seat last fall. He lost to Democrat Alyssa Slotkin by only 0.14% of the vote, despite being outspent $51 million to $13 million. While Republicans are united, Democrats face an ugly primary that won't be settled until August. The establishment candidate is Representative Haley Stevens, who has served in the House since 2019 and is positioning herself as a centrist. State Senator Mallory McMorrow is presenting herself as a younger, more exciting, more progressive outsider. She gained national attention for torching a GOP legislative colleague over trans rights in 2022 and slamming the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 in at last year's Democratic National Convention. There's also a socialist running, Abdul El Sayed, sought the Democratic nod for governor in 2018 and has Senator Bernie Sanders backing. The two drew a wild crowd of thousands at a recent Fighting Oligarchy rally in Kalamazoo. This sprawling primary fight could work to Mr. Rogers' advantage on fundraising. In July, the Republican raised $1.5 million and has $1.1 million cash on hand, which he can focus on the general election. On the Democrat side, the candidates reported raising between $1.8 million and $2.8 million that month, and each had from $827,000 to about $2 million on hand. But Mr. Rogers' respective opponents will have to spend all their money on a hard-fought primary. After more than 100,000 Michigan Democrats voted uncommitted in the party's 2024 presidential primary to protest President Biden's Middle East policies, Israel will be a major dividing line. Ms. Stevens is a strong supporter of the Jewish state, Mr. El Sayed, a vocal critic, with Ms. Morrow positioning herself between the two but leaning toward Mr. El-Sayed. These candidates will also likely move left in the primary on issues like DEI and transgenderism, and away from swing voters. The governor's race could also hurt Democrats. Detroit Mayor Mike Dugan, a popular business-oriented Democrat, is running for governor as an independent. That could complicate attempts to unify the party and to maximize turnout in Detroit, with spillover effects for the Senate race. But the Democrats' biggest challenge is the state's changing nature. After taking Michigan by healthy margins for six consecutive presidential elections, Democrats lost the state to Mr. Trump in 2016 by 10,704 votes. Mr. Biden clawed it back in 2020 by a narrower margin than Democrats traditionally had, and in 2024, Mr. Trump won the state by 80,103 votes. Mr. Trump converted traditionally Democratic strongholds in the Upper Peninsula and the Eastern Thumb, making rural Michigan much more red in the north and south, and cut the Democratic margin in Detroit to 2-1. It was enough to offset the GOP's decades-long slide in the Detroit suburbs, its decline around Grand Rapids, and the growing Democratic margins in college towns like Ann Arbor. With a national Democratic brand in shambles, Mr. Rogers should make the case that none of his squabbling opponents share the values of ordinary Michiganders. This argument is important as advancing an agenda that helps Michigan families and strengthens the economy. The Republican coalition also contains a chunk of Trump-only voters. In 2024, almost 123,000 Michiganders voted for Mr. Trump, but didn't bother to vote Mr. Rogers in his summit race. And nearly 114,000 of Trump voters didn't vote for any Republican congressional candidates. By comparison, Kamala Harris outperformed Ms. Slotkin by a bit less than 24,000 votes. The presidential endorsement will help, but Mr. Rogers must find a way to get Trump-only voters to show through the president's name isn't on the ballot. The Republican must also turn out non-college voters, mostly right-leaning, who are less likely to participate in midterms than college-educated voters. Most important, Mr. Rogers needs the economy to be strong, especially manufacturing and the auto industry. And he must raise lots more money this time. Much is likely to change in the 14 months before Election Day. But in Michigan, Republicans have the chance to capture a Senate seat for the first time in over three decades. The reason might not be contained to one state. The Democratic Party's problems are large and growing. Venezuela boat reversed before U.S. strike. A U.S. military aircraft struck a boat suspected of smuggling drugs in the Caribbean several times from the air last week, even though the vessel had turned around and was headed for shore before the strike began. The boat was hit several times until there was no movement on board, according to a person briefed on the incident. The strike killed 11 people on board the vessel, who U.S. officials were said were members of the Tren de Aragua criminal gang. The new details are likely to intensify scrutiny of the Trump administration's claim that destroying the vessel, rather than attempting to interdict it, was justified because it presented an imminent threat to the U.S. administration. To the U.S. Administration officials have argued that the president has the power to order military action against imminent threats to U.S. without congressional authorization. The revelations come as U.S. officials said the Trump administration is preparing additional strikes on suspected drug smuggling vessels in the Caribbean as part of an expanding military campaign to target criminal groups that is designated as foreign terrorist organizations. The Pentagon has deployed a significant amount of firepower to the region, including 8 Navy warships and 10 F-35 jet fighters. 3 Marine Corps amphibious ships were exercising near Puerto Rico over the weekend, while the USS Lake Erie Cruiser and 2 destroyers sailed in the Caribbean. In the midst of the buildup, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth paid a surprise visit to Puerto Rico this week. Hegseth, who had warned the mission in the region won't stop with just one strike, told sailors and Marines on the USS Iwo Jima warship that this deployment wasn't training. This strike sends a clear message. If you traffic drugs towards our shores, the United States military will use every tool at our disposal to stop you cold, Sean Parnell, chief Pentagon spokesman, said in a statement. The attack on the small Venezuelan vessel was the U.S. military's first publicly acknowledged airstrike in Central or South America since the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989. Trump has told aides he was impressed by the strike and the precision with which it was carried out, lauding how well the military performed. White House officials have signaled that more strikes are coming. Vice President J.D. Vance has called targeting drug gangs the highest and best use of our military. Details about the attack remain scant. U.S. officials haven't disclosed the location of the strike, the identities or nationalities of the 11 people they have said were killed on board the vessel, or which weapons were used to sink it. Pentagon officials briefed a handful of staffers on Capitol Hill on Tuesday, limiting the briefing to individuals with the highest security clearance, according to two people familiar with the discussion. The defense officials, including personnel from the Joint Staff and Pentagon Unit overseeing Special Operations Policy, told staffers that the president ordered the strike in self-defense, relying on his authority under Article 2, constitutional authority. The New York Times earlier reported details of the vessel's turning back to the courts before it was hit. The administration was planning additional strikes, the briefers added, adding that Trump wasn't planning to ask Congress's permission. Participants on both sides of the aisle left the briefing dissatisfied, according to a person with the knowledge of discussion. Even before the new details became public, some Republicans called for the administration to provide additional details on the legal justification for the strike. My first question was, are we going to be able to see information that the administration had identifying them clearly as part of a terrorist organization, said Senator Mike Rounds, Republican South Dakota. If they got that, that satisfies a lot of the questions that we otherwise would have. Trump officials initially offered conflicting accounts of the circumstances regarding the attack. In the hours after it happened, Trump said the vessel ferrying drugs was heading to the United States. At the same time, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said it was probably headed to Trinidad or some other country in the Caribbean, where it can contribute to the instability these countries are facing. Later, Rubio suggested that the shipment was eventually headed to the U.S. Thank you for joining me for this edition of The Wall Street Journal. Have a great day.